About 6 or 7 years ago, I think, I was flipping through the bins at a bookstore now gone on 12th Street in the Village. Some of you may remember it was a couple steps down. I think it was just called 12th Street Books. And I came upon this envelope, and I have a thing about envelopes. I published for about 10 years a series of folded broadsides in envelopes, and I was also very struck by it, just graphically. I had never seen it. And inside were cards. There's even a little ribbon that, if it had still been in its original condition, had a bead, and you could pull the ribbon and it would lift the cards up out of the envelope. And they're very tarot-like images. And I started reading this book, and I was immediately captivated. It's a book by Edward Marshall. Ed Marshall. It's a book not many people have seen. It's called Transit Glory by Edward Marshall, Drawings by William Heine, Carp and Whitefish, New York, 1967. And at the time, carp and whitefish didn't ring a bell for me. Except the sort of what ancestral bell of, Sunday morning lox and bagels. But I want to read the book to you because it's very brief. I fell in love with it right away. The first page is a publisher's note. "We formed to put the bulk of Marshall's work into print, but a door has never creaked open more slowly, and we apologize to the poet and thank him for his patience. Our pilot project, printed in blood during the summer of 1966, was never issued, and on a shelf where we keep our inks, a copy floats pickled in alcohol like a stillborn sea monster. Panagrady was our sugar daddy and lady combined, and our printers were the bees Swami Bhaktivedanta got buzzing." I have a table of contents which credits five of the poems having appeared in Measure issue 3. And I'll show you the images, and you take a look at this afterwards too. Well, you can see them when I read it. Providence to Boston. Roger Williams spoke for freedom and went to Providentia, but I see some chickens, Rhode Island Reds, en route to B Town. Chickens. Off at Back Bay, to Bickford's, maybe to take a quick look. Too late for a quickie, though. Roosters. At Route 128, suburbia meets to keep passengers from the city, but no stampede of jackets on the train to take us home to the hay loft. Pigeons. In Roxbury, goodbye, Mansard. I hope you pick up that Victorian stuff flooding the Lower East Side. Keep it in Roxbury, thank you, thank you. Goodbye, new brick development. See you rubble in 1960. Bye. Nashua to Boston. Where are you two crew cuts with ears going? To the Commonwealth? I hope the Treasury is well. Goodbye. The golf course. I am on the way that is going somewhere. I have never been taken by every breeze, but I travel on the curve, on the tracks, to that white mountain state to check the big wind at Boston, who blows the chauffeurs where they wish to go. By the Senator's House. On the curve last night, up that hill, where I said I would do it again and again, if her sister said she will, and she said, I will it. voyeur on the telephone pole. Going up the hill on the curve, one sees new construction going on, houses being built, bees bringing in the pollen, blonde hair strung on the lamppost. At the mansard. My nose has been clean for 2 days. Little soot and beautiful white doilies around, even on collars and cuffs, and I haven't had to cuff off, as Toussignan used to say in New Hampshire, and he was Canuck in the view of his background. Type it up, if you will. Such strange transfigurations and conjectures, and yet I went up and I felt the fingers trembling in the hair, but it takes a hand to hold my head and shake and tilt it to get me shook up. Only then will I put on my kilt and hold the bagpipes, for I am a Scotsman that holds the world at bay. I laughed while the hands were on me, but a Pentecostal said that wasn't sacrilege, for there is a holy laugh, too. And it must have been a holy laugh, for just before I sat down at the table, I sang out the doxology, holy, 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 and then I sat down for casserole with bread toasted. On the bus. To Mr. Hooten and Newton, and I am a Hooten. From Worcester to Boston, I noticed the elastic type, which I believe I am, two fine boys with packs on their backs, scouting, but I doubt very much cruising, for they weren't sea scouts. And I believe with right tact I could get them, one with a French cap, black, the other with a Mexican sombrero. Seated opposite are the aesthetes with piano teachers' voices, but I doubt whether they pump the organ, unless they are compelled to make a squeak. The elastic ones take off, one aesthete to the other, don't come over to my house. And one gets out at Marlborough, and the other one, the squeakiest, crosses the street at the end of town to a butch. Curiously, there are two left on bus. What could they be? Hooten, except the athletes, and they are going all the way to Boston. One had a football, the other suitcases. There, Hooten lions, wolves and bears, and yet the symbols are ambiguous when you think of it. That is your prerogative to think as an anthropologist with emphasis of your hands on the anatomy. Just what will the athletes do at the Greyhound? Inspiration, let me see your specimens. I have got it all over you, for I let mine participate and dance before me and unfold everything they've got to do, like Rhoda, who kept silent until the thunder roar. Now I am elastic, expanding my rubber bands everywhere, and I take down notes with the pen that Aunt Celia gave me after I obliged her for writing down for her at Planned Parenthood meeting. I believe you and Sister Margaret Sanger should get together. While you are a Hooten, I shall continue clearing up my rhymes on my fishing lines while little fairies whistle and put on flies and bait. And so I say goodbye in front of BU, School of Theology, where psychology and religion go parading in front of Marsh Chapel. Why not Forest Chapel, where the nymphs can play? And that is why it is a swamp, for the Bergsonian life rhythm school who drinks on waves but doesn't take radium. Radium, keep back the waves. Let the water be quiet for a moment, just long enough to make the sun parch the throats of the idiots. Let them see the process when the rain comes down again. In northern Indiana, I sat down on my suitcase, and the moo-moos gathered together at the fence, horned and eyed at me. Then I rose and they vanished through the grove on the walled side of the meadow. And this was because of an earlier shower of blessing in this Amish area. So that's Transit Glory. I sort of sped through it, but with any luck, we'll bring it back. I just was really captivated by this book. And Ed Marshall, I knew the name. I wasn't sure why I knew the name. I got home, and I dug out my copy of his first book, Helan, Helan, published by Auerhahn. And then I also realized, oh, Carp and Whitefish. I have another Carp and Whitefish book. And it was the second book actually issued which was a book called The Invention of the Letter, A Beastly Morality by Philip Whalen, which has never been republished, although the entire thing is online. Someone scanned it. It's a tale about the invention of the alphabet in the Garden of Eden, with all in calligraphy with drawings. It's really wonderful. And so I thought, well, so who is Carp and Whitefish, and what is this, and whatever happened to Ed Marshall? I started asking people, and I, of course, quickly came to what he's best known for and most remembered for, which is the long poem, Leave the Word Alone, which is in the New American Poetry. It's the longest single poem in the New American Poetry, and his only contribution to it. A brief excursus on Carp and Whitefish is that it was the project, one of many very interesting projects of Irving Rosenthal. And Irving Rosenthal shows up for our literary purposes as a graduate student in Chicago in about 1957, where he's the editor of the Chicago Review. And he, I don't know what leads him to Burroughs and the Beats as a graduate student editor at Chicago Review. Obviously, someone puts him on. He reads something, maybe he reads some Kerouac, something. He starts writing to people, and he publishes an issue of the Chicago Review with Burroughs and Kerouac and other Beats, which he follows up with a Zen issue. The third issue, the second Beat issue, is suppressed by the college. A local columnist writes, without having read it, of course, writes a scathing indictment of it in the local paper. University pulls the funding, suppresses the issue. All the editors but one quit en masse and start Big Table. Rosenthal is the editor for the first issue. Paul Carroll, who was the poetry editor for Chicago Review, loses his job at Catholic school over this. He ends up taking over Big Table, and from issue two on through issue five, he's the editor. Irving has had enough, because Big Table also has a big problem with the post office and a near court case and various things. It goes on for years. Irving decamps to New York. And I presume through John Wieners meets Ed Marshall. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that it's through John. Irving, by that time, is already very involved with John. He's in love with him. He moves in with him at one point, and he almost single-handedly gets him out of Medfield. He hires doctors, he hires lawyers, he writes letters. He really spends campaigns for a couple of years to get John out of Medfield. So I assume that that's how he gets on to Ed. And he becomes very devoted to Ed's work. Panagrady puts up money for Irving to buy a printing press and type and gets set up. And his express purpose is to bring the work of Ed Marshall into print. And his initial idea, let me read you, it's brief enough. I'm not going to try and follow any kind of strict chronology, but in the Ed Marshall, in the Irving Rosenthal papers at Stanford, which I eventually found my way to, he writes, A Brief History of the Unpublished Marshall Book. This is 2001, he's writing. On my return to New York from Morocco in 1965, I was surprised to find Ed Marshall no more understood than he was in 1960, before the publication of Helan Helan. I decided to correct that. I had Marshall gather all his poems, some that had been published, but most in manuscript. After going back and forth between publishing his poems with a little weeding as a single book, and publishing them as a series of small books, I chose the latter, in order to give the reading public small bites of his unique vision until they got used to it. Panagrady provided the money to buy an IBM executive typewriter, a Chief 15 press, and supplies, and to pay stipends to a typist and artists. Doris Nieder collated various versions, manuscript and published, of the long poems Leave the Word Alone and How Deep Is Thy Love. The artists I chose were Bill Heine and Michael Coulter. The first book, Transit Glory, was published in 1967. This was a book of travel poems. There were to be a book of devotional poems, a book of sexual poems, a book where the color yellow predominated, and so forth. I moved to San Francisco at the end of October 1967, fully intending to pursue this project, but the immediate needs of, quote, free and communal actions here diverted me from it until 1972, when the suspension of our weekly intercommunal newspaper, Cauliflower, gave me time to resume work on it. On reconsidering the project, I decided to publish the poems in the form of a single book, and with the help of my fellow communards, who were now experienced in printing, began to plan this book technically and editorially. We called it Pol Volt, a title that had originally been chosen in 1966. Now I think that one of Marshall's own titles, Shamba Yahanda, would have been a better choice. In the meantime, Marshall had been informed of our plans and apparently had been promised a commercial or perhaps more lucrative form of publication, for in 1973 I got a letter from him forbidding me to proceed. Of course, I honored his wishes. To my knowledge, no alternative book ever appeared. So, in order to kind of give a little context to this, Irving Rosenthal is a project in and of himself, and I'm fascinated by his editorial career, which he has absolutely no interest whatsoever in being documented or paid any attention to. He's still alive in his late 80s in the commune that he founded in 1969 in the Mission. Still there. It's kind of amazing. And that, quote, free was he, along with, in alliance with the Diggers in San Francisco in the 60s, became converted to the philosophy, the one-word philosophy of free. And from that point on, never sold another book, or everything was free. In fact, he took all the copies that he had printed of the Philip Whalen book, had Whalen write out the word free in calligraphy in a couple different styles, made them into rubber stamps, and stamped all over the books. I have one, so there are copies that are stamped and unstamped, but it's stamped free all over it. So now let's back up. Kind of, there's already an indication of a trajectory of where I end up going, but to back up and give a little background on Marshall and his life. And what I've been able to find so far, I just need to find one page. He was born in Chichester, New Hampshire, in 1932, June 1932, just outside of Concord. His father was a farmer. His father was born in West Gloucester, as it turns out, which is sort of interesting. And there's something that would be interesting to pursue further, right? I do have the dates, and his father's parents. His paternal grandmother was from Nova Scotia. He was the third child. Two older sisters. Here we are. So his father, also Edward H. Marshall. So our Ed Marshall is Edward Harris Marshall, Jr. His father was born 1891 in West Gloucester. His parents were William F. Marshall, also born in West Gloucester, dairymen, and Florence N. Harris from Bear River, Nova Scotia. Marshall's mother, Lena Watson, born in 1897 in Sandwich, New Hampshire. Her parents were Daniel Watson from Tamworth, a farmer, and Fanny Pittman from Alexandria. So his mother was a teacher, his father was a farmer. They were married in 1921. Next Tuesday I'm going to the weekly meeting of the Chichester Historical Society, where one of the members assures me that there will be older members who will remember the family. I also am going to consult all their town reports, because I've only been able to find the name of the middle sister, not the oldest sister. Anyway, he was born, his parents were on a farm on a road just outside of Chichester. His mother was a teacher, but very soon after he was born, she was committed to the New Hampshire Mental Hospital in Concord. So he was raised by an aunt and uncle, Frank Marshall and Etta Marshall, in Concord. And that's where he grew up. So he grew up blocks from the hospital where his mother was interned. But as far as I know, don't, if you have to leave, it's no. Or you just called.
Yeah, no, I'm called.
Okay. As far as I can tell, and I want to document this, but as far as I can tell, he never saw his mother. He spent 5 months in the same hospital at the age of, I think, 19, and didn't see her. She was the next building, I think. He was brought to her when he was still an infant, and he talks about this in Leave the Word Alone, that his mother said to her sister-in-law, I think, "Oh, you have a nice baby, Etta." Not knowing, or not recognizing, or not understanding, or just simply not accepting that it was her child. So he grew up thinking that his aunt and uncle were his mother and father. Disabused of this, I guess, as a teenager. He goes off, he spends a year or two, I think maybe separated, in a University of New Hampshire and another smaller college. That's really about all I know, other than what the poem Leave the Word Alone tells us about his father, let's say, about his family life.
You don't know the diagnosis of when he was committed to the asylum?
When he was committed, no, I don't. And again, I only know what he says about his mother, which is that she liked to read her Bible and her health book. You know, the sort of implication that she was maybe overly devout, like Christopher Smart, who Ginsberg compares Marshall to, comes up a little later. I'd love to know, and I doubt that I'll be able to get access to those kinds of records because I'm not family, but maybe I'll meet someone who will be able to tell me something. But where we next pick him up is in Boston. And I knew that he met Jonas, and that through Jonas he met Wieners and Joe Dunn and Michael Rumaker and Blazer and Spicer and this sort of whole circle. But what I didn't know, and what no one really could tell me, is how did he meet Jonas? What was their connection? At some point he says, and it's in a letter somewhere, he refers to Jonas as having taught him about love and poetry, which I just found absolutely, you know, completely tantalizing. Well, after having really pretty thoroughly looked through the Rosenthal papers, and the last time I was there even photographing the complete, close to 200-page, I mean, the book was in corrected galleys, ready to go to the printer, when Marshall said no. So Irving had taken it very far. But I was looking elsewhere, and I went up to Marin County and interviewed Dave Hazelwood, Auerhahn Press. Marshall was an employee. I mean, essentially, he was house-sitting for Hazelwood in San Francisco and answering the mail for Auerhahn. And then, of course, Hazelwood published his first book in 1960. So I talked to Dave Hazelwood, and I went then to the Bancroft, where the Auerhahn Press archives are. And there I was able to get Marshall's correspondence with Don Allen and with Dave Hazelwood. But what I found, to my surprise and sort of, you know, enormous thrill, was about 50 pages of poems in the form of letters and letters in the poems of forms between Jonas and Marshall in the Jack Spicer papers. So how it ended up being preserved in the Spicer papers, when it's just this correspondence between Marshall and Jonas, is a mystery I have hunches about and going to try and pursue with Kevin Killian. But so I'm begun transcribing these Marshall-Jonas papers, and it's clear that they met on the common. You know, I think it was a pickup. But Jonas then proceeded basically to give Marshall an education in, you know, American poetry, and to try to talk him out of his devout faith, which I think, you know, there wasn't a chance that that was ever going to happen, but it's very interesting to see what Jonas pulls out to try to talk him out of that. They seem to have lived together for a while anyway. Marshall was always peripatetic, mysterious, led multiple lives. Dave Hazelwood talks about him bringing these men to Auerhahn offices, executives, people from completely other worlds, and Hazelwood had no idea how Ed moved in these different worlds. you know, preaching on the street one day and, you know, in a boardroom maybe the next day or who knows what. So I think that Marshall, I know that Marshall was still in Boston in 1954. I don't know if he was there at the reading, at Olson's reading in September. I think maybe he was. But if he wasn't, he certainly heard about it from Wieners and Dunn, and Michael Ruemmerker was there too, right? Was he at that reading? I think so. I could be wrong about that. As things develop, Marshall moves to New York in 56. And at that point, the early, I'm sure there's quite a few that are lost, but the early Jonas letters are very, he's reading in the Riot Act. He's really telling him he has to shape up and get serious and drop all of this Anglo-American cultural kind of background, Eliot and Dylan Thomas and these sort of things. And he's just laying it out for him, what he needs to be reading and how he needs to be thinking. But once Marshall moves away, the tone really changes and it's very tender. And he's saying, when are you coming back? And we can't wait to see you. And Jack Wieners, you know, says this and we got to do that. And then he's writing about Measure. And it's clear that Jonas really felt a strong affection and that everyone was excited. And you see this in the Wieners letters. Seth Stewart and Robbie Dewhurst have sent me whatever they find in the Wieners material that refers to Ed. Wieners clearly thought that Marshall was a genius, as did Rosenthal.
Was Spicer in Boston briefly in like the 50s? And did this Jack Spicer?
No, it's clear it's Jack. It's Jack.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Jonas always refers to Wieners as Jack. In these letters.
His family did too. It was always Jackie.
Yeah. But he may have met Spicer in Boston. He certainly had a little contact with Spicer and Blazer in San Francisco. So he moves to New York in 56, works variously in bookstores and preaches on the street, works in various church-related capacities, is ordained in 1965 in the old Roman Catholic Church. It's clear to me that he had early in his life he had at least two callings, which is to say the religious calling and poetry, and then he drops poetry, but he never drops the religious calling. He up to the end of his life is very involved in the histories of these schismatic sects, which he's a bishop in at least one or two of, and another bishop, a fellow bishop, who Robbie Dewhurst located in Florida, who knew Marshall for 30 years and never knew he had been a poet, was flabbergasted to learn he had been a poet, referred to him as a savant who could recite the lineages of ordination going back generations in these various sects. So Marshall's poems, I think, take a big turn under the influence of all these intense, heady people in this context. But still quite quickly, I mean, in 1955, he writes Leave the Word Alone. And I think by then, when do the Wieners and Ruemmerker get to Black Mountain? Does anyone know offhand what year?
Yeah, John graduated in 54, so he went. And when was Eric King Hazel? In 55, he went.
Right, so in 55, they're passing this poem around in manuscript, and Duncan says in one interview that was the poem everyone had to read. Everyone was talking about it. Creeley in another interview talks about being there and how this one student who cannot get why poems are laid out in a particular way on the page reads that poem and it suddenly clicks. And Olson gets it, and Olson becomes very enamored of it. And it's through Olson's agency. I don't think he had to work terribly hard, but he persuades Creeley, you know, to include it in the last issue of Black Mountain Review, 1957. And I'll to give you a little flavor. So Christopher Wagstaff, in the collected interviews with Duncan says, in 1956, the exciting poem for everybody at Black Mountain was Edward Marshall's Leave the Word Alone. Ginsberg has said that Marshall's poem had given him the key to Howell. People had copied Marshall's poem, and Charles was very excited about it. And then from Ralph Maud's, Charles Olson's reading, it's in the selected letters also, quoting the selected letters. On receiving it, Olson wrote to the young poet, "That's a fine thing you've done here, Marshall. Very true and quick, very thick. It speaks very much. It is very personal and formal at once. And form-wise, it is very true. The peopling, the protests, the end." So Marshall is corresponding with Charles, and that poem is published in Black Mountain Review. His mother's great-grandmother was part Indian, part Native American, Rhoda. And Rhoda shows up in the poem, and at one point in his letter, a letter to Dave Hazelwood, he refers to getting the Black Mountain Review and saying that Rhoda looked so good in a white slip, under the white cover of the book. There's other correspondence at stores, which I'm going to see next week. But Marshall clearly, he had the opportunity, or was at least urged to go to Black Mountain, but didn't go. Garrett heard a story that his bishop forbade him to go, because it was what Charles told him. So he doesn't go to Black Mountain. He goes to New York and stays in touch. And through Irving, and because of Wieners too, but mostly through Irving, he goes to San Francisco in 1960. He hitchhikes. Some wonderful recounting of his hitchhiking trips in his letters to Hazelwood, letters and cards. And he makes two trips in that 1 year. He goes to San Francisco. He's there for a while. They work on the book. There's some idea about opening a bookstore with Hazelwood, and Marshall, being naive and very enthusiastic, is going to be the distributor for all these small presses somehow. He's going to take over where this other distributor is failing. He comes back to New York and tries to pull things together and goes back to San Francisco. He thinks he might have the chance to take over the Bread and Roses Mission in North Beach, which was a Christian coffee house run by Pierre Delattre, owned owned by the Congregationalists, but really run as a kind of meeting place, flop house, coffee house, performance space, Christian coffee house. I mean, it was a very famous place in the 50s. He wants to take it over. Irving and John, everyone's sort of excited, but the Congregationalists, he's way too strange for them. And so he's very bitter, and he goes back to New York, leaves San Francisco for good at that point. The text of Leave the Word Alone that gets published in Black Mountain Review, typeset in Mallorca, a lot of errors. Same text repeated in the New American Poetry, and then repeated again when the book is published as a pamphlet in 1979, which is actually kind of, as far as I can tell so far, the end of Marshall in a poetic context. So he's in New York, and Irving has taken up the project again, and he notifies him, and the point at which Marshall says, "Don't publish it," he's very close at that point to Arlene Dahlberg, Edward Dahlberg's, I think he was still alive at that point, so not widow yet, but ex. And she had a press called Persia Press. She did a book of hunkies, and she did, so here's Helan Helan, Auerhahn Press, 1960, and here's Leave the Word Alone, 1979. I'm jumping at Pequod Press. So Irving is convinced that through Arlene, Marshall had been led to believe that he could have a better deal, but that never happened. There are two records that he read twice at the Poetry Project in the 70s, 1973, 1975. 1975 with Michael Ruemaker, dying to hear those tapes. They're buried at the Library of Congress in the Poetry Project archives that are not yet accessible. Other than the videos from around 2000 that Jerry Portnoy, is that his name, put on YouTube of Marshall coming to visit him.
Diabolical player? What's that?
The harmonica player?
No, the Hunky Hunky's executor.
Executor. And he went down. I think he was in North Carolina at the time, right?
He went to North Carolina, visited Marshall.
Yeah.
That's right, not the other way around. And so I've seen those, but I've never heard Marshall's voice except for those late videos. So I want to get those tapes at some point. So as I said, he gives these readings. In 1979, this third instantiation of the same corrupt text, I'll Leave the Word Alone, is published. Now, it's not enormously different, but there are lots of little corrections. And what I brought with me, which I can show you, I was thinking of reading it, but it's cold, is a corrected version. That's one of the things that's in this big book of Marshall's that hopefully we'll see the light of day at some point. Let me read you just a couple tidbits, very briefly, really just a couple sentences from the Jonas Marshall material, because it's so much fun. There's, I mentioned that Ginsberg credits Marshall with giving him the impetus and the key and the inspiration for Kaddish. He talks about it in many places. When Arlene published this, she asked him for a preface. He wrote a five pages set in type 8.5 by 11. It would be, like a 10 typewritten page preface. She only used maybe a quarter of it or a third of it. The whole thing is available online. Simon Pettit on the Ginsberg blog last year was editing the tapes of three different classes at Naropa where Ginsberg talked about Marshall. And so we put up a link to the whole piece called Marshall's Service. And I also put up a very brief Marshall biography on my blog for him to link to, just so there could be something semi-authoritative about his life. So in the very first letter of Jonas, 28 December 1953. Dear Ed, yes, I shall expect to be at home on the evening of the new year. Indeed, happy that you read the Eliot essay. As I have said to you, he is okay for criticism and drama, but for an up-and-learning writer, stay away from his poetry. It is poison. Goes on. The High Church of England or the Welsh feudal customs of clipped Celtic jargon will never be your center of operation. The first decade of this century saw or welcomed to the end of Anglo-American style. We have our own brand of English that is opposed to British speech, both in music and idiom. This bit of revelation will sink into the American university sewer system in about a decade or two, if our children are that lucky. I repeat and repeat to you, O hard-headed Yankee, to shake those moonbeams off your fanny. Poetry and prose is no picnic for picking pansies. It is a man's full-time job, and the sinecure is pence, but we are favored by Zeus, and kings shall stand in awe when we speak. And it goes on. Second letter, Edward, you are, I fear, on the brink of losing your spark. Goes on. Then there's a poem. Then there's a long railing against the church. Then in April 56, Ed Marshall, since our paths will part shortly, I feel I should ease your befuddlement by giving you this little tale that amuses me but will give you some peace, and I think I know why. Then he proceeds to give yet another version of Jonas, of his own heritage and upbringing and all of that, which correlates in some parts with other versions. But then February 1957, we have this change in tone. Dear Ed, what gone and left us for New York? I am still with my chung, but it's not the same without you. What's New York got that we don't got? Then the next paragraph. Sorry I didn't see you when you were here 2 weeks ago. I was locked up in my apartment and didn't hear the door. When you come this weekend, just look over the door at 40 Grove Street, top rear, and get the key and go in, and you're home. Please bring with you such writings as you may have at hand, as Jonathan Williams at North Carolina is most anxious to get my, your, and Spicer's things to take to W.C. Williams. Jack W. Wieners had a letter from him this week, and he was upset because we didn't comply on his previous demands. As I totally forgot that 40 Grove Street, I just spent the night in my girlfriend's mother's apartment, up maybe three doors from the last night. Then he tells him to go out and get Poet in New York, and talks about he and Spicer on Lorca. And just one more excerpt. I say there's 50 pages of this stuff, including these long poems of Ed's. 31 July 1957. Dear Ed, measure is un fait de compla. It is being assembled for the males, as against male mins, and I suppose the, quote, frequency and persistency of the bells. Your things read better in the mag than on type paper. Oh, how well I can recall that day from your white mountains you arrived to me, spirit sent, upon the mid-entre gate to the Queen's Gardens, holding out to me those T.S. poems, and I shouted louder than your own Black Webster, Daniel. Hell, man, you've got to see the thing. Congratulations, and I am the happiest and a better man having met you. I hope you are planning to get over to Boston within the next 2 weeks. Jack has a number of things to go over with you, and all of here in Ray the Mag and this winter. Olson will be here, and since you are coming back, I feel it as well that Olson conduct one of his broad talkathons. You are for it? So, there are, as I've kind of indicated, there are these tantalizing indications of these other dimensions to Marshall's activity. Clive Mattson, who knew him in New York, and who I interviewed Clive recently in Oakland, and I guess Hunky basically was like a father to Clive, and that was his entree onto this world. But he described Marshall telling them about speaking in tongues at a church in Brooklyn and actually demonstrating. I found in Rosenthal's archive a religious tract, the kind that, you know, are given out free on the street by Ed Marshall, specifically targeted towards IV drug users, towards junkies. It's called The Drug and the Drag, and it is absolutely brilliant. I cannot find another trace of it. I tried contacting what's now the kind of religious publishing company that then was publishing these tracts. Of course, they have no interest whatsoever in pursuing whether anything like this is in there, you know, whether they have any of this. Now I'm just trying to talk to everyone and anyone who knew him. There are people still alive who knew him, and but they're disappearing every day. Mary Baraka, who I wanted to talk to. I've got to get to Michael Rumaker. I've got to get to Ayla Kokanen, who was the art director at the Chicago Review and moved to New York and knew Wieners and Rattray and Marshall and part of that whole scene. And she's in Woodstock now.
Bill Heine died recently.
Bill Heine died recently, just, you know. And Marshall himself, no one knew whether he was still alive. And Robbie Dewhurst, you know, paid one of those online genealogical companies to be able to get the records, and we were able to find that he died in 2005 in Marshall, North Carolina. No connection, total coincidence, right? I mean, no family connection to the name of the town.
Isn't Panagrady still around?
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, in France, right? And I don't know if she knew him. She certainly got the book. She was the first person to get the book, I think, because Rosenthal sent her copies. There's a letter to her, actually a wonderful letter from Rosenthal to her. I could go on. I mean, the thing that I would do if there was more time was just read you more of the work, because it's really wonderful. Leave the Word Alone, of course, is readily accessible. It's in the New American Poetry. If you haven't read it, or if you haven't read it in a while, go back. It's pretty terrific. The Ginsberg blog, the lectures on Marshall, and the link to the piece by him, Marshall's Service. And I can also send any of this stuff to anybody who's interested. Helen Halan is easy to get for $20 online. Transit Glory is very hard to find. I'm going to try and find out if the sisters are still alive, because I can't think of anyone else who could claim any kind of really legal issue about the republication of the work. There are no heirs per se. Both of his sisters would be in their 80s. I don't think he had any contact with his family as an adult, so I doubt they'd even be interested. But as due diligence, I'll, and also because I'm curious, of course. And I don't know, of course I'll talk to Joe Torah and share this Jonas Marshall material, and maybe some of that we'll see a light through Let the Bucket Down or in some other context. And I hope we'll have a big book of Marshall's. I think he's really interesting. I think, and that work in Transit Glory is so completely different in tone and tenor and than Leave the Word Alone, and it's obvious that I like that kind of span, you know, wide span of stylistically, you know, in my own work and in other people's work. So,
yeah,
anyway, what am I leaving out, or does anyone, can anyone fill in any gaps or have any questions? Or
so, Garrett, there's that Down Here magazine where John had that diary. He was living with Steve. Remember, him and Steve was going through a tough time, and I know that John was in the hunting. Do you think that he lived with Marshall too in New York City at that time? Or
it's possible. I don't think so. He was living in Rattray.
No, right.
Joel Martin.
And I think that by then, Marshall, that would have been when, like the 60s?
I think
my feeling is that Marshall really, though he hadn't completely given up poetry, he had withdrawn from the social world of that. Let me read you one short letter. And there's a man who was a literary critic named J. Kevin Quinn. I don't know if any of you will come across his name, but he writes this letter to Irving, and before I talked to Irving, in which Irving insisted that Marshall said he had a better deal, I thought that this might have been what was behind the forbidding of the publication of the book. This is brief, it's handwritten. So it's from J. Kevin Quinn, in Albany, New York, 1966, August 30, 1966. Dear Irving, Edward was here over the weekend and is on a destruction kick. He wants to get his manuscripts back and burn them. So watch out, be on your guard, and don't say I told you. He and Fusco, who eggs him on in this pursuit, tend to berate all those interested in the care and preservation of his, Edward's work, and the forwarding of his reputation. I told them, gave some advice to Edward, to leave you the hell alone, but that puts me on the shit list too. Of course, I'm always suspect. Edward opened the packet he had given me in New York up here, and they contained only sermons, so I hope you have all the poems, originals and copies by Xerox. If not, then he's already done away with some of them. Please tell me if he gave you stuff after you took the first batch of my Xeroxing efforts. Because if he did not, then you are missing a great deal of his work. He was carrying on all weekend about how he hates his poetry and that you are trying to bring up his sensuous past and are in an art conspiracy against his aspirations for oblivion and death. For Christ's sake, he's a bitch of a saint, isn't he? Please write me if you have the time and tell me how you are getting along and anything I can do to help. So, the bitch of a saint.
What year was that?
66.
But later he lets the Dahlbergs publish, Arlene Dahlberg publish something.
And he gives readings in the 70s. So he obviously, there's a pendulum there. And I can find very little trace of Quinn. I literally found one. He didn't seem to publish any books. He seems to have been involved in a protest at maybe SUNY Albany or wherever he was teaching and only lasted a year there, and then he sort of vanishes. Very curious about him and how he knew Marshall.
How many years was he locked up in?
He was only there for 5 months. And he talks about it in Leave the Word Alone. And who knows, maybe I'll find some newspaper articles in the local paper in Chichester or something. I'm hoping not only to meet a couple people, but to enlist people there to help me dig further. I mean, all of that, of course, is just to help contextualize the work. I didn't say just, but I mean, that's the main thing. It's not as though there's a biography in the works, but it's just...
I'm interested in being able to get his medical record.
Confidential, so, I'm not family.
But it's it varies so much state by state.
Is it a state institution or a private state?
I know, for instance, I have a particular performance piece that I do that involves death records.
Uh-huh.
And I've done it in Arizona and in Portland. And it's completely different state by state. In Arizona and in whatever state I was trying to do in, sealed for 50 years. Just even the names of people who've died.
Mm.
Can't get access to it 50 years later. In Portland, it's public. So, I mean, in Oregon. So it did. I don't know what the story is in New Hampshire. I'll find out, you know. But
live free or die.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. This was my first attempt to try to give a context to